accession number 27058, Real 1.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Robert Ulrich in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 10th of the 12th, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Robert, can we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
Robert Young Ulrich. I was born in H. Fremantle, on the 21st of June 1922.
Tell us a little bit about growing up in Fremantle.
Well, Fremantle was at best a one-horse town, very small country place, but to me it was the centre of the world, that's all I knew. It was filled with forests and still is today, but I lived there with an aunt for many, many, many years, and I went to school there, to a funny little school called White Gum Valley, which is still there. I drove out past the other day just to have a look for old time's sake. And I thought Fremantle was the centre of everything. And I lived with my aunt, Mrs. Harry Flindle. She had 9 children in those days. I think there were 9 of them. And one extra skinny one like me at the end of the table didn't make too much difference. The problem with me is, and something that probably affected most of my life, I came from a broken home. And when I was 2, my parents divorced, and both of my parents were what you would call working class people, and funds were not ample. And I spent the rest of my year, until I was 16, when Mum remarried again, just going from family to family member, Dad's side, Mum's side. And I remember what aroused my interest in aeroplanes. I was living with my grandmother in Guildford, and my father came to visit one day. I was about 4, and we went for a walk just around what was then called the Common. It's now called King's Reserve, I think, and they've got a bit upper crusty in Guildford, I think. And while we were walking, I heard a very strange sound that I'd never heard before, and was coming from the sky. So I looked up to see what it was, and I saw this funny thing flying through the air. And I asked my father what it was, and he said, well, that's an aeroplane. And from that moment on, all I ever wanted to do was to fly aeroplanes. I asked my father what I thought was a perfectly straightforward question, and I was quite surprised when he couldn't answer it. I said to my father, while it's flying through the air, do the wheels on it keep on going round and round? And he said, I don't know. And I thought, well, you're not as clever as I thought you were. But that aroused my interest. And everything I did from then on was aimed at somehow learning to fly aeroplanes. I joined a very small glider club, which was based out here in City Beach. That was about 1934. And we built gliders, which we flew ourselves. We weren't very successful because we had no money and everything was done sort of catch-as-catch-can. And by this time my mother had remarried, and I got a job in what was called the E&G, which was the Electricity and Gas Company, same place now is called Western Power.
When would that have been?
I was about 14, I think. I hated school, absolutely loathed it, never learned a thing. Absolutely loathed it, didn't learn a thing. So I left school at 14, got a job with the ENG, joined the WA Gliding Club, and all the time we were aware that there were the sounds and signs of war were developing, and all I thought about, and everybody else in the club, was to join the Air Force. And that was where I ran into my first big obstacle. Because I hadn't had an education, all my education has been state school, and for some reason they believed that to fly aeroplanes you had to be frightfully clever and know all sorts of funny things about maths and so on. So you had to complete what was called the 21 book section, and once you joined the Air Force, if you were accepted, and many were not, they gave you these 21 books, which came to be known as the 21 book system. started off pretty basic, about sixth standard, and went up the leaving, which was well and well and truly beyond me. I was about 17 then, and luckily I met a very delightful old gentleman who's dead now. He was squadron leader Thomas Le Chemeron, and he was the senior educational officer for the RAAF. I was about 17. You weren't allowed to put a request in to join the Air Force until you had your 18th birthday. And luckily he took pity on me, knowing I was scratching for education. And he went out of his way very, very often to make sure I got every possible available help, which I did over about 12 months, and I finally got through, much to my surprise. I joined the Air Force on the 26th of May 1941, and we marched into PS Air Base one afternoon, and we were number 15 course. And all the other blokes who were already at the air base, the 13 and 14 course, they greeted us with a famous old chant, "Oh, you'll be sorry, you'll be sorry, you'll be sorry." So we were divided into groups and given various instructors, and it was for the first 6 weeks what they used to call boot drill or boot camp, you know, army drill, rifle exercise and other such what times, I think, to try and effect some sort of discipline. We finished there, I can't remember when, but then we went to Cunton, which was known as the EFTS, the Elementary Flying Training Scheme, and flew the very wonderful Tiger Moth, or the DH-80, the Havilland 80, a little biplane. Beautiful aeroplane to fly, superb. And I got through that. And then we went to Geraldton, which was advanced flying training, on what was then the multi-engine, twin-engine Avro Anton.
Before we go too much further, yep. I'm going to just bring you back a little way, yep, and sure. Ask you to tell me about the coming of the war years. What you understood of the rumblings, as you mentioned earlier of another war.
Well, I knew that there would be another war. I'd heard a bit from my grandparents, because I had two uncles, neither of whom I ever met, both of whom went to Gallipoli in the First World War, and they were both killed. That's all I knew about the war. If you went to the war, you had a fairly good chance of getting your head knocked off. I also thought there was a fair bit of adventure, and this was the days of Errol Flynn and John Wayne on the silver screen showing how clever they were with aeroplanes and all sorts of things. So I knew it would be something between one and the other.
Let's talk about the situation as you understood it. And how was Gallipoli seen, for instance, as a young man, young boy possibly, recalling those days?
I was told by both my parents that the Australians were sent there by the British. Douglas Haig, I think, was the British Field Marshal, who apparently was responsible for sending Australian troops to Gallipoli. And in our house, General Haig was fairly well hated because of two uncles I no longer had. That's all I knew about the war. But I knew that if you went to war, you had a fair chance of staying there permanently in one shape or another.
The Depression years, how did they touch you and your family?
Well, of course, I didn't realise there was a Depression. I can remember when I was about 12 or 13, my pocket money was 2 shillings a week. But I never felt deprived about that. I could go to the Ambassador Cinema on a Saturday afternoon, I think that was fourpence, and see the latest Buck Rogers or Hoot Gibson or Hopalong Cassidy. The comics were about tuppence, a decent ice cream was a penny, and as far as I was concerned, 2 shillings saw me through the week. I never felt in any way deprived. I always have clothes for school, but being the bottom of 9 cousins, I used to get plenty of hand-me-downs. I'm not sure if I ever had anything new to wear until I bought myself a pair of slacks of what used to be called a Walsh Brothers, no longer in existence, for 17 and sixpence out of my first pay packet.
What about your interest in other parts of the world as a young bloke growing up?
Not really, just anything to do with aeroplanes suited me. I often wish I'd been born in England, because there was Croydon, which was filled with aero clubs, and they had aero clubs all over England, and they had aero clubs and glider clubs all over Germany. But in Western Australia, we had this one very small glider club which ran on a pittance because nobody had any money. To give you some idea, the year's membership for the glider club was exactly 2 and 6 pence. So that was my knowledge of the Depression. Everything we had, we pinched, made from something else, altered something, or somehow acquired something. It was often as well not to inquire too deeply how this particular art was actually acquired.
Let's talk about your situation in relation to living in Australia.
Yep.
How was England seen?
Well, I often lived, I lived there because they had snow. I'd never seen snow in my life, and just vistas of skis and tobogganing, that struck me as a great deal of fun. But of course, we didn't have it in Western Australia. I never ever thought in my life I'd ever go to England or get out of this place. See, in those days, somebody who had limited education, good jobs and good positions were very, very hard to find. And I didn't have the mental capacity or the fortune to get into a university or anything like that. It was way out of my reach.
But how was England seen in relation to Australia?
I think it was generally regarded by my grandpeople, we called it the mother country, and everything I think that happened in Australia usually happened because the same thing happened in England. Both my grandparents were German, so there wasn't too much I was told about England because it wasn't their own country.
What in relation to going off and fighting for England?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you knew a little bit about the First World War.
Yep.
What was the general view of particularly as the Second World War came along, what was the particular view of going away to fight for king and country, for instance?
Well, I think it was the accepted thing. You used the term king and country. In those days, I think that was seen as part of the course. You were expected to. I can remember the phrase, do your duty towards king and country. That didn't worry me a bit. All I saw was a couple of aeroplanes that I had a chance of getting into, and that's what guided me.
What did you know about the rumblings, as you mentioned, of troubles in Europe that would lead to war?
I can remember as a schoolboy, I went to the cinema one day, and the Prime Minister of England then was a fellow called Neville Chamberlain. And I remember he'd been to Germany to talk to Adolf Hitler and Goebbels and a few other of those fellows whose names I can't remember. And he got off the aeroplane and he was waving a piece of paper. And I can remember what he said, there will be peace in our time. I have spoken to Herr Hitler and Herr Goebbels and they said they have no further aggression being on so-and-so. I thought, well, there goes my bloody chance to get in from an aeroplane.
How did people see that? How did people see Chamberlain coming off, waving this?
Well, I think the great number of people that I knew hoped that he was right. I don't think anyone was particularly keen on war. Not for any reason.
People believe him, though?
I don't think they did in the general sense. I think he was seen as a fairly weak sort of a character. I think that he may have been a satisfactory Prime Minister had the peacetime condition prevails. But I think what saved the world was when he resigned under some pressure, I believe, and when the Winston Churchill became the wartime Prime Minister.
Right, well, we can talk about that too when we get to it. What were your thoughts of people like Hitler growing up?
I thought he was full of hot air, to be honest. He was some sort of an orator, but I don't think he was particularly good. I think he was talking to people who wanted and liked to be convinced.
Well, certainly there was that situation of Germany having suffered tremendously as a result of the Versailles treaties and then the Depression. How was Germany seen? How were the German people seen?
Oh, I suggest to you they were the enemy. That was all there was to think about Germany. The best thing about a German, if you saw one, you shot the bastard. The quicker the better.
How are they seen in peacetime, though?
I didn't think much about him in the first time. I'd never met any.
Let's talk then about, you were mentioning Chamberlain. That was in 1938.
Yep.
A year before the Troubles, almost to the day, a year before the Troubles would come about. What was the feeling then, knowing that there was another war likely, another world war likely, so shortly after the first?
Well, I think people were frightened of probably the great unknown. They knew, for instance, I can remember my stepfather complaining bitterly about there'd be petrol rationing, and my stepfather was a great cigarette smoker. And he said, they'll be rationing tobacco and they'll be rationing petrol. You'll have to buy one of these awful gas producers and put it on the back of the car. It was going to be awful. And that's about all I knew, really.
In relation to the coming of the Second World War, did you understand fully the demands that Hitler was making?
Yes. I understood that he was... in my opinion, hell-bent on world domination, no matter what, no matter when. And I believe today that the German people are absolutely convinced that it's their right to rule the world. They tried twice last century. They were better prepared the second than the first. And I'll bet you all the money you can find in the bank they'll try again this century, and they'll be better prepared than they were last time. I think they really believe that that is their worldly right.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see.
Yes, by the time it comes again, it'll be too old for me.
In relation to the coming of the Second World War, what was it like to hear we are now at war? Do you recall Menzies on the radio?
Yes, I heard Menzies night. The first job I got when I left school, I joined a company called, can't remember now, but I finished up as a rouseabout on a shearing team up in the north of Western Australia. And we were all on the shearing team. There was about 30 of us, I think, made up the shearers, the rouseabouts, the workers, the so-and-so. And we were all on the beach at Carnarvon one night, and one of our number must have had some money besides being a shearer, because he had a portable radio, something I'd never seen in my life. And we were all on the beach catching crayfish. And I remember Mr. Menzies saying, it is my solemn duty to tell you we are now at war with Germany. I can recall it very clearly.
Obviously an emotional memory for you. At the time, how did you feel?
I saw bigger aeroplanes being available, and more of them. All I was ever interested in, never wanted to be a fireman or a policeman or an engine driver, pilot, the only thing I wanted.
Who are your heroes? Who are your flying heroes?
Well, unfortunately, Manfred von Richthofen was one of the good ones, and of course he was German. I think he's credited with over 80 kills, I think, but some of that may be Hollywood. Cobber Cain was a New Zealander. He was in England, and he was killed, unfortunately, on a little trip he took before he went on leave. There was a Finnegan, Paddy Finnegan, an Irishman, who was a very fine fighter pilot, I think he was flying Hurricanes. Louis Truscott I met once or twice, but I don't think he was quite in the same bracket as Finnegan and Cobber Cain. And when I first joined my first squadron, which was an Australian squadron in the desert, we had a fellow called Neville Duke, who for a little while became an instructor of mine. Neville Duke was a tall, thin Englishman, smothered with DSOs and DFCs, a quiet bloke, and I did some training with him, and he was unbelievably accurate. Every time he fired his guns, some airplanes fell out of the sky. And I said to him one day, how the hell do you do that? And he said, come on, I'll explain it to you. So we went to the mess and got a cup of tea. And he said, well, when you see the enemy airplane, you establish and work out your deflection, that's the amount of you have to aim in front of you. Just establish that firmly, then double it and add a bit. I said, well, where you got me is the bit. How much is a bit? He said, well, you know, a bloody bit, a bit. It's all simple. Oh, say still, clearly I asked you the question, old chap. He was definitely an ace. After the war, he became the chief test pilot at de Havilland, but I think he'd be dead by now. And we had another ace on our wing, which was 239 wing, Billy Burton, another Englishman. He was a fantastic shot. Oh, God. He did a matchstick. And I asked him once or twice how he did it. And he said, haven't you got a book on deflection? I said, yes. He said, well, read the bloody thing from the first to the last page. Gee, terrible, ever so, Billy. Thank you.
In relation to the idea of becoming a pilot, how were the other forces seeing the infantry, for instance, the Navy?
Well, I just didn't have any interest. I only had interest in things that led to aeroplanes. I mean, all the submarines in the world and all the battleships wouldn't have caused me to open an eye if I was asleep. All I was interested in was an aeroplane. And if possible, one of my own.
Let's talk about then joining up. What was it like to join up? What did you have to do?
Well, you had to pass that bloody dreadful 20-year book series first, which I did with the aid of Squadron Leader Le Chemin. And in those days, we used to meet every Saturday and Sunday at the bottom of Barry Street Jetty for what they called General Calisthenics. And there'd be 400 or 500 people every Saturday, Sunday in public holiday. And we'd just go swinging these Swedish bells, and what are they called, Swedish dumbbells and things, and running, and the old medicine pool played a big part, and ping pong balls and tennis balls. And every now and again, each service would send down a raft of their own particular people. There were colonels from the Army, captains from the Navy, and group captains from the Air Force, and they'd all tell you how good their own service was and what the pay was and how you'd automatically be promoted rapidly, because we were all such obviously clever fellows, and the pay would be so good, and we have smart uniforms, we go all over the world.
Was anyone persuaded to?
I wasn't. I'm a person with very fixed ideas, and when I said aeroplanes, I meant aeroplanes. What fly in the sky?
How were flyboys seen in the Air Force by others, do you think?
Oh, well, I'll tell you something that's quite funny now. I haven't got this to show you. When you joined the Air Force, you were given what was called a forage cap, which was a cap you wore on the side of your hip. And if you were aircrew, they gave you a little bit of white felt, and you put that in the front of your cap so that it told the passers-by, anybody who saw you coming, that you were an aircrew trainee. And that added a little bit of extra swagger to the walk, I think. But we did find out later on that some horrible blokes of the Army told a lot of local girls that anybody wearing that white was on leave from the local VD hospital and should be avoided like bloody plague.
Now, there was a bit of
rivalry, I suppose. I don't think we took it too seriously. People wanted to drive tanks. People wanted to do all sorts of things. But my interest was simply aeroplanes.
You mentioned, obviously, joining up and what was involved. And the early days, before you had a chance to fly a plane, what did the training involve? You mentioned
training drills, what we call square bashing, you know, rifle drill, which drove you bloody mad after a while because it was repetitious and repetitious and repetitious.
But presumably you wouldn't need to know all that being in the Air Force?
I think that was an idea to create some sort of discipline. I never quite understood it myself. There are about 50 people on my course. I don't think anyone understood why we did it. And we absolute bastard of a sergeant who was no longer with us. And he kept on telling us he was permanent Air Force. Well, that was a big thing in those days, permanent. We were classed as HO, hostilities only. And when the war finished, they could keep us for 12 months and then we were dumped. But HO was a terrible social thing to have next to your name. Hostilities only. But I think that was just a way of filling in time.
In relation to getting in to the actual art of becoming a pilot. Tell us about that.
Well, when I went to Cunderdon, with a name like Ulrich, I was at the end of the course, and I was in what was called D Flight, which had a very fine bloke called Bob Giles, who I got to know very well later on. But my instructor was a sergeant, Sergeant McLean, who was an absolutely very, very, very fine fellow. And I can remember the absolute excitement when I first had it, that aircraft we took off. I thought my world was just beginning to develop. And Sergeant McLean was a very fine bloke. And all the mistakes I made, and I made a few.
What were some of those mistakes? What were the biggest mistakes you would have made?
Trying to learn to slow roll was a problem for me. You know, when you turn the aircraft 360 degrees. I just didn't, in the first place, didn't seem to have the proper coordination between moving my feet, make the rudder like the aeroplane turn, and moving the control column so that the aircraft banked in coordination, and that gave me some trouble. But after I finished all that, when I was a fighter pilot, I never used that ever in my life. In fact, you were told as soon as you got to a squadron, if you played any silly buggers or any fancy flying, you get a fair bit up the arse. That wasn't what you did in a fighter squad. Got that clear, or you want me to say it again? Okay, got it. Okay.
Well, presumably you'd need those sorts of things if you were in a dogfight. A fair amount of acrobatics would help.
No, murderous. Biggest mistake of your life. If you've got some clown sitting behind you, armed to the teeth with bloody guns and bullets, and they all seem to have those, if your aircraft's doing that in a straight line, you're a perfect bloody target. If you see an enemy aircraft, what you want to do is slip and slide all over the bloody place. Anything attempting a deliberate manoeuvre, which is predictable by the bloke who's behind you, because he's done it too, he'd know what's coming next, and he'd just say, well, wait for the stupid bastard gets up there, and bang, he goes, then bang, bang, bang. The first thing they told you, any stupid show-off flying, aerobatics, fancy flying, you're going to get a boot up the arse. Got it? Oh, yeah.
In relation to, you mentioned, obviously, and again, another emotional remembrance is your first up in a plane.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What was it like then to get a chance to fly the plane for the first time?
Well, they get you to a stage, I can't think what they call it now, but everyone likes to see how long it takes you before you go solo. And because my flying instructor was a sergeant, he wasn't allowed to send his people solos. Only important people like those holding a commission and being a sir were allowed to send people solo. So when Sergeant McLean thought I was ready, he told the flight commander, it was Bob Giles, and Bob Giles took me up, and we did a circuit. He said, do one more. He said, fair words. And as we taxied in, he just threw back his Sutton harness and said, stay where you are, go and do two circuits, and then come back and land. So I said, okay. So I did.
And what was that like?
Beautiful.
Any apprehension?
No, not really.